From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. If the Bush administration is serious about fighting a war on terror, it needs to step up action on the economic front, says a new study. A lack of serious trade and investment agreements between the U.S. and Arab nations has exacerbated the isolation of those countries from the global economy and deepened their political tensions with the West. Tonight on Point, American trade policy and its effects in the Middle East. We begin with the rising debate in Turkey over preparations for possible war with Iraq. The Turkish parliament postponed a scheduled vote today over whether to allow U.S. troops in the country, holding out for a larger multi-billion dollar aid package from the United States. Dexter Filkins is Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times. I asked him to explain the significance of the postponement of that parliament vote.
The short answer is time is running out. American officials have said that there are literally American ships in the water full of American troops in the Mediterranean, in the eastern Mediterranean, and they're trying to make up their minds, should they turn right and go to the Gulf, or do they turn left and go to Turkey? So it's really just a matter of how long can you keep tens of thousands of American troops sitting on ships waiting in the eastern Mediterranean for someone to tell them which way to go.
And it seems pretty clear-cut. Washington wants a northern front. It makes sense for U.S. troops to be there. Washington believes that will shorten the war. And on the other hand, Turkey has an economy that is very fragile, wants the best deal it can get. So what's your best guess as to who's likely to blink first here?
Well, that's very well put, who blinks first. It's just so hard to say. I mean, you're at the point today where each side has presented what it says is our final offer. It's like they're arguing over the price of a carpet now, and, you know, the one guy walks away and says, I'm not going to buy it.
I'm done, right?
Maybe. Well, you know, so you're really kind of at that stage, and it's a kind of a messy thing to watch because the United States and Turkey have been allies for a long time. Turkey's a member of NATO. It's a democracy. It's secular. It's wealthy. It's all the things that make a good ally. And so things have gotten a little ugly, and I think that's making both sides kind of uncomfortable here. But, you know, it's 10 p.m. here in Istanbul, and the Turks are waiting for an answer from the Americans, and they haven't gotten it yet. So, you know, the clock is ticking.
What kind of dollars are we talking about here?
It's a lot of money. The Americans, and this is after weeks and weeks and weeks of negotiations, the Americans just said, okay, our final offer is $6 billion in grants, which is extraordinary. I mean, that's just an extraordinary amount of money, and $20 billion in loans. And I think the Turks came back with their final offer and said, we want $10 billion in grants, and there's this $7 billion that we owe you for military equipment. We want you to write that off, and then we want $15 billion in loans. So it's just a lot of zeros, you know, and decimal points and stuff. And I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, the Americans have told the Turks, if we decide to go into Iraq, we will do this whether you cooperate or not. So it's up to you. And so I think there's a sense here in Turkey that if that's true, if this war is going to happen and the Americans are going to do it, then they don't want to be left on the sidelines watching it happen. At the same time, there's a great concern here that it's going to wreck the economy. I mean, if you think back for a moment to 1991 in the Gulf War, 500,000 refugees crossed into Turkey from Iraq in one day. That's what they're thinking about. And, you know, the economy, they claim they lost billions of dollars in trade and, you know, the borders essentially closed between Iraq and Turkey. So they're saying, look, you know, if this is all going to happen again, we want to be ready this time and we want to try to insulate the economy as best we can. And, you know, you're going to be spending far more money than this on the war itself. So here's our price tag. But it's, you know, ultimately it's about money. And it's, so it's kind of crass and sticky and messy. And so here we are.
Tell us a little bit about Recep Erdogan, who is one of Turkey's top politicians. On the one hand, he seems to be talking tough, and then the next minute he turns around and says, oh, no, we're confident this can work itself out.
Well, you know, he's a very good politician. He is. He gave a speech today, and just as an example, he gave a speech today, and I saw the speech, and I read the speech, And there's something in there for about everybody. And there's lines in that speech that suggest, I mean, he says at one point, look, don't think just because we're your ally here and just because we're letting American engineers in here to lengthen the runways on our military bases, don't think that means that we're going to approve this stuff, you know. And then later on in the speech he said, you know, we can't be left on the sidelines if there's going to be a war in Iraq. And so it's really, really hard to tell. I'd love to be a fly on the wall when the Americans and the Turks have to sit down and really finally do the deal. It'll be fascinating to watch.
There's one other factor here, Dexter, and that is that Turkey's a country, as you know, where 96% of the public oppose the war. So it does sound as if it would take a very good deal indeed to sell it to the Turkish public.
I've been yelled at for thinking this, but the overwhelming majority of the Turkish people are against the war. There's absolutely no question about that. I mean, they think, look, the war in Iraq on our southeastern border just means trouble for us. That's basically the way everybody thinks here. But I think on the other hand, you know, this is a democracy, and it's a Muslim country, but it's a very secular one. And it's not like you're talking about 90% of the people being against this in Saudi Arabia or Jordan or some of the Muslim countries that border Iraq. It's a very stable place, and there aren't, you know, 10 million people in the streets demonstrating against the war every day. So I think it's more a question of how the government here would present this to the people and how it would finesse it and the arguments that it would make. But it doesn't mean that it's not doable.
And in the meantime, as you say, those ships are on their way somewhere.
You can imagine them sort of sitting there. If there could be a fork in the road in the eastern Mediterranean, and the Suez Canal is on one side and the Turkish ports on the Mediterranean are on the other, and they do. They have to turn. So here we are.
Thank you so much, Dexter Filkins.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Dexter Filkins is the Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Istanbul. The Muslim world has been the blank spot on the map of the Bush administration's trade policy, says a new study by the Progressive Policy Institute, a Washington think tank. Barriers to trade and investment, such as high tariffs on exports to the U.S., inhibit the ability of many Muslim nations to participate in the global economy. Driving this phenomenon, in large part, is the fact that many Arab countries have historically been reticent to open up their borders to foreign products. But as the U.S. fights the war on terror, experts are increasingly pointing to the dearth of economic bridges between the U.S. and the Arab world as a barrier to fighting this war. The underlying concept? Failing economies in Muslim countries are creating a burgeoning pool of unemployed citizens, frustrated and angry at their governments and at America. They ultimately contribute to a growing pool of potential recruits for terrorist groups and threaten to make the war on terror a very long uphill battle. Is the economic fight against terrorism equally as important as the military one? If aid isn't the answer to creating stabilization, is free trade? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us now on the line from Washington is Ed Gresser. He is director of the Project on Trade and Global Markets for the Progressive Policy Institute. He was also the U.S. Trade Representative's principal policy advisor during the Clinton administration and is the author of that recent study, Blank Spot on the Map, How Trade Policy is Working Against the War on Terror. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Gail. How are you?
Good. So glad to have you with us tonight.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Gail. Welcome. Great to have you with us.
Well, thank you. Good to be here. Ed, I want to start with you because a little over one year ago, January of 2002, in fact, you asked in a similar report, and I'm quoting, why does the Western Muslim world seem so much more given to violence and terrorism than other parts of the world? Why do radical nationalism and fundamentalism appeal to so many of its people? And can Americans do anything about it? You're asking that question again, particularly the latter one, with renewed urgency, it would seem, and now you are focusing even more on trade as the answer to it. Why so?
Well, I think the economics of the Western Muslim world, which I take to mean about 30 countries from Morocco through the Middle East to Pakistan and Central Asia, about 700 million people, has really gone through a kind of depression in the last 20 years. Their share of world trade has fallen by about 75%. as regions like Central America and Southeast Asia have diversified and become more industrial and put more people to work, the Middle East and the countries just to the east of it have remained focused really on oil. They haven't been producing jobs, but they have been producing people. The population in this part of the world has grown to about 250 million. Most of this is in cities. In the case, for example, of Morocco, its population has gone from 19 to 28 million, and 8 of the 9 new million are city dwellers. So you have a population that is more urban, more educated, more aware of the world around them, but also one that's suffering from actually declining living standards. If you look at the Arab world, I think per capita income is down by about 30 or 40% since 1980.
Is there any good news here?
There is some. I'll get to it. But before I get to it, what the basic context is of a very rapidly growing group of unemployed young men and young women, and that is a type of situation where you're going to have trouble almost anywhere in the world. Now, what is causing it? Why has this part of the world basically not developed while Southeast Asia, for example, has? I think a lot of it has to do with the trade environment.
Actually, all Ed, of these can I ask you, we're going to be teasing out those answers over the course of the next while. So rather than laying it all out at the beginning, let me ask you to do this for me, if you will. I have made a solemn pledge to everyone concerned that this is a program about ideas and not about all of the intricacies of our trade policy. So if you will, give us a little bit of a primer just to get everybody on the same page in terms of who sets trade policy? What's the role of Congress? I mean, who's making these decisions, and how much does it fluctuate from administration to administration?
Constitutionally, Congress sets trade policy. In practice, administrations sort of set an agenda, and Congress then either accepts and ratifies it or rejects it. Within the administration, the lead organization is a group called the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. This is a small agency created by President Kennedy about 40 years ago, whose mission is to oversee the development of trade policy and to conduct the negotiation of agreements. When the agreements are done, Congress either votes for them or votes against them.
Now, I know you served under the Clinton administration, but I'm trusting you for a fair and impartial answer here. Did the Clinton administration do any better at particularly this trade issue with the Arab countries than you believe the Bush administration is doing?
I think a fair and impartial answer is that the Clinton administration did one very good thing. It negotiated a free trade agreement with Jordan. This was the first such agreement the United States had negotiated in the Middle East or with a Muslim country generally, and it's been quite successful. I think in light of hindsight, both the Clinton administration and Bush administrations really didn't see the overall context, didn't see the economic problems of the region as a whole and develop a strategic approach to solve them.
And let me ask you about one specific case, and that is the matter of Pakistan, because we heard from Pakistan's foreign minister a month ago that economics, he said, was the key to fighting terrorism. And yet Pakistan wanted about $1 billion in additional sales of textiles and clothing to help pay its anti-terrorism bills. The United States just gave $143 million. I'm wondering if it's risky to hold out this carrot of more trade and then sort of snatch it back after just a nibble.
Well, it's risky to promise it and not deliver it, that's for sure. I think we should deliver it. You know, the Pakistan case is a pretty compelling one, I thought, where you had a lot of disinvestment from Pakistan, companies getting scared to set up factories there and people getting put out of work because of the war in Afghanistan. And, you know, they needed some help. We gave them a little, but we didn't give them as much as I thought we should have.
Jack Beatty, I want to hear from you quickly.
Oh, the Pakistan story is something that can bring despair to the mind of the civic-minded civilian. I mean, basically, as I understand it, in order to get in order to get fast-track authority through Congress, which allows Bush to make trade deals without having to stipulate every measure with Congress, for his agreement in the Western Hemisphere, Bush made an agreement with a Carolina congressman. All right, we won't take so much from Pakistan in return for your vote on free trade in the Western Hemisphere. So it was Pakistan lost in the horse trade.
All right, we'll continue talking about U.S. trade policy in the Middle East. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris, and this is On Point.
from Boston.
This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about how the U.S. trade policy in the Middle East affects the war on terror. How can you deal with the roots of terrorism without taking on the economic issue? Can you see buying Arab goods as your small part in the war on terror? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Again, that's 1-800-423-TALK. And we've been talking with Ed Gresser, who is director of the Project on Trade and Global Markets for the Progressive Policy Institute, also the author of a recent study, Blank Spot on the Map, How Trade Policy is Working Against the War on Terror. And as always, with us is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Jordan credits its free trade agreement with the United States, which was passed in 2001 and is the only one between the U.S. and a Muslim country, as boosting its economy. Earlier today, I spoke with Salah al-Bashir, the Jordanian Minister of Industry and Trade, who helped broker Jordan's free trade agreement with the U.S. He serves as the co-head of the U.S.-Jordanian free trade agreement with U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick. And I asked him why and how Jordan entered into a free trade agreement with the United States.
Basically, in the middle of the 90s, Jordan decided that it should liberalize its foreign trading regime. And also, it well understood that in order for Jordan to integrate in the world economy, we need to benchmark our internal regulatory system as far as the compliance, labor, environment, intellectual property rights to the standard that would allow us to do so. We had an exercise with the World Trade Organization by which we conformed to most of the requirements there. And then we've approached the U.S. and posed the question to go into a free trade agreement. And definitely hard work and compliance with a model of how integration should be was rewarded with the Jordan-U.S. free trade agreement.
Although it did take several years, I wonder if you could briefly describe for us what the agreement includes.
The agreement actually deals with freedom of movement of goods across borders between U.S. and Jordan on an agenda of dismantling of tariffication over 10 years. And basically, the substantive part of that will happen in the first 3 or 4 years. The agreement has to cover everything. There is one exclusion, which is tobacco, basically there. And it has to cover all trade as part of the right approach to economic solutions with international trade.
I know this is still relatively new, but have you found an impact on the economy yet, and particularly in terms of the average Jordanian?
Actually, we've seen some successes. The volume is relatively small, but we had success with the QIDs and the systems work. So we are optimistic that that will impact the country. The trade with the U.S. on both these modes contributed to create about 35,000 jobs in the country. And that figure is substantial if you know that Jordan is a country where 5 million people are there, and the people under 18 are about 60% of the population. So quite a large part of our labor force work on U.S.-related trade relationship.
Is the average Jordanian aware that this agreement even exists?
Oh, yes. It affected the lives of a lot of people. At the same time, having access to the most sophisticated market in the world, which is the U.S., helps also raising the profile of investment in this country and also helps in creating the awareness of the need to have market access through compliance and sustainable development, environment, and labor. And therefore, the average Jordanian, but also our average target investor, knows about this agreement, and we believe it's one of our economic successes in the recent several years. In total, our exports to the U.S. is about 20% of our exports, up from zero just 3 years ago.
So it's perhaps opened some doors that might not have been easy to open otherwise.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I want actually to add, if I may, the supplies from Jordan, notwithstanding the nervousness around this region, will be uninterrupted. I mean, we have access to the logistical export areas through Aqaba and through Tel Aviv. We can deliver goods out of this country in less than 25 days, and we assure all our buyers that the goods will be on time, the quality that meets the satisfaction of a sophisticated buyer, and sustainably, regardless of the nervousness around this region.
Thank you so much, Dr. al-Bashir.
Absolutely, you're welcome.
Salah al-Bashir, Jordanian Minister of Industry and Trade, who joined us earlier from Amman.
Ed Gresser, that last plea from Dr. al-Bashir certainly seems to underscore some of the worries that are in Jordan now and also how important this agreement is to them.
Yes, I think so. I mean, if you think about where Jordan is physically, it is right between Iraq and the Intifada. It's not a comfortable neighborhood. And nonetheless, you know, with the agreement and particularly with the internal reforms that they've done and which Dr. al-Bashir mentioned, they've really been very successful. It really is a testament to how much you can achieve when you work at it.
So whose fault is it that there's not more free trade? Is this something that the United States can impose on Arab countries if they're not willing to open their doors?
We can't. I guess I'd rather not talk in terms of fault, because I'd like to think of it in terms of a problem that we ought to try and solve rather than looking for blame. But I guess the answer to your question is no, we can't impose internal policies on them. We can recommend things that we think might help and point to the example of countries like Jordan. And we can use our own policy to sort of help countries that are trying to do their best to succeed. Whereas right now, I think...
I was just going to say, if you're saying that this is a blank spot on the Bush administration's trade map, that sounds pretty critical.
Yeah, I think here's my basic point, my real worry about the Bush administration policy, is that we have very aggressive and sort of strategic-minded policies for Latin America and Africa and also possibly Southeast Asia. And in those cases, we're going to be taking our tariffs really down to zero. For the Middle East, we don't have such a policy. And so not only is the policy essentially one of neglect, but it's going to wind up unintentionally being a policy of a kind of a discrimination where we say, sell us duty-free clothes from South America or from South Africa. Don't do it from Pakistan or don't do it from Egypt. That's really what worries me and what I think needs to be fixed.
And in fact, it's an interesting point. If you go to the U.S. Trade Representative website, you don't even find the Middle East mentioned as a separate region. It's folded in under Europe and the Mediterranean.
Yes, it is. That's right. The people who work in that office are quite good, but they have a very, very heavy workload to carry.
Jack Beatty, you want to jump in here?
Well, you know, stepping back from this, if you ask, what is the Bush administration's long-term policy toward dealing with what you might call the matrix of terror, to avoid the word roots? We don't want to say that there's root causes, because obviously it isn't just that simple. But the field of forces that bring about terrorism, that propagate it, well, one thing it was doing was it was conducting a war of ideas, quote-unquote. Well, that consisted of hiring an ad person named Charlotte Beers, who sold Tide to try to sell America in the Muslim world. That they recalled her ads. So we're not doing that anymore. And then the second thing we have is the economy. And as we hear from our guest, we're not doing what we can with trade. That leaves us with the one strategy we seem to have, which is that by toppling the Saddam Hussein regime, we will loose what one enthusiast calls a tsunami of democracy across the Middle East. And that's the long-term anti-terrorist strategy. You get the tsunami of democracy going out of Iraq, and pretty soon you don't have to worry about terrorism because the governments that are now oppressive become legitimate. People can vote. Well, that's quite a if that is our sole strategy, as opposed to the economic side and the side of ideas, you've got a long time to wait before that tsunami begins to produce its results.
And tsunamis are not always that controllable or that predictable, right?
That's for sure.
I mean, the one recent example you have is Algeria, where they did try to democratize, and it was a catastrophe. I mean, it's resulted in a 10-year-long civil war and 100,000 people dead. And I think you have to be working the democracy angle at the same time as you try and give people something to do in their daily lives. If you don't, then it's very hard to make this tsunami happen, and if it does happen, it's hard to make it point in the right direction.
Let's get some of our callers in on the conversation. Jack is on the line from Boston. Jack?
Good evening. Thank you for having me. It's a really good show, and I really appreciate that the role of the United States in all these terrorist matters is finally beginning to be analyzed a little bit. I called just to make a quick point. I'm a history professor in college level, and I have a lot of Arab students in my classes, and we discussed this quite a lot. We were wondering the other day why, let's say, that all the Western industrial powers have been pouring so much wealth into the Arab region for probably 90 years, and they're still so poor. And these students tell me that one of the reasons they're over here is that, well, look at it this way. Imagine that history had left a foreign power in the Appalachian coal mines, and these powers were taking our coal out, bringing in little wealth, hurting the environment, impoverishing the population. How would we feel? That's why people like Osama can get a hearing in the first place. That might be obvious. But I think for Bush to dismiss world opinion as a focus group today and to say that our policy is only a function of our own needs, well, if you think the U.N. is weak, just wait till the U.S. boycotts start. And then, you know, we'll see what America's power really means.
Ed, what's your response?
Well, I think the students are kind of examples of this general phenomenon where you have less and less to do and more people. I don't really blame the United States for buying oil from the Arab regions. They're selling it to us. What I worry about is we're not doing enough to help them end their dependence on oil, to have oil as a moneymaker but not the main source of finance and jobs. That's what's really dangerous to me.
I was going to say, do we view them as this gigantic filling station, and as long as the oil flows, then everything's fine, and in fact, there are other products that we could be getting from them?
I think there's something to that. They have to make the case for themselves. I mean, you have to expect some sort of strategic vision from the governments over there too. But you know, we shouldn't just think of this as a place where we buy oil, because then that's not a long-term healthy relationship. It's not healthy for the people over there either.
All right. Let's say hello to Raseem, calling in from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Raseem?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Please go ahead.
Hello.
When I go to shopping, I see goods from all over the world, mostly from Far Eastern countries, China, Taiwan, and this and that. But I don't see too many from Middle Eastern countries. I think it would be great to encourage them to produce more and export to the States and Europe. And maybe it would be good to invest in those countries and promote workers, gain more, earn more, and maybe bring democracy to their countries. That was my comment.
All right. Thank you so much for the call, Raseem. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point. Ed, what about that? How can the United States encourage these goods to come in here without running the risk of the appearance that we are forcing trade on the Muslim world?
I think Raseem is quite right. I think that's a very, very sort of blunt common sense view of things, and I think he's absolutely correct. If you look in the department stores, he's quite right. You see most clothes come from Asia and Central America. You will also see more and more clothes from Jordan, and that is because we're eliminating tariffs on clothes from Jordan. If we did that for the region generally, I think you would see quite a lot of investment from retailers and clothing makers go into those countries, and you'd put a lot of people to work quite quickly. A lot of those 35,000 people the minister is talking about are garment workers.
I think you point out in your study, Ed, that there's more direct U.S. investment in the one country of Sweden than in the whole of the Eastern Muslim world or Western Muslim world. Is that right?
Well, it's even worse than that. That's worldwide investment from all sources. There's about $13 billion a year flowing into Sweden and about $13.5 billion flowing into all the Muslim countries put together. It's 1.3 billion people. It's really astonishing.
And it's also astonishing how quickly that can change. If I'm remembering correctly from your report, Ed, the Jordanian figures went from something like 16 million in exports to 400 million in a fairly short period of time.
Yeah, about 3 or 4 years. And these types of industries that are labor-intensive, that produce light-manufactured consumer goods, you can put a lot of people to work in a very short time if you put your mind to it. And we can accomplish that really without pushing a lot of our policies on the governments there. Just by changing our own trade regime, we could encourage it quite a bit, I think.
All right, we want to hear now from David, who's calling in from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Sorry, David, we're having trouble hearing from you, so perhaps we can try again on another line. Let's go to Michael, who is in Somerville, Massachusetts. Michael?
Yes, good evening.
Yes, hi, come on in.
How are you? I'm glad to talk about you about the economic and also the political problems in the Arab world. I do see this as the biggest problem in the Middle East, which is democracy. And democracy is linked to economic prosperity because an undemocratic government doesn't have a real... Hello?
Yes, we're listening. Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Yes. And the sad thing about it is that we have, I do not blame, the Arabs have no one but themselves to blame about what has happened to them and, you know, and what's going on to them right now. Because the U.S. and also the United States included, we have seen them supporting right-wing and democratic governments that oppress their people, that do not give them a right to vote, that do not give them a right to do anything that we cherish and that we enjoy in the Western world. And that's very sad. And the problem is also is that these undemocratic governments do not share the common wealth. It is not in their interest to do so because if they share the wealth, they will lose their power. And that is the problem in the Arab world, is sharing the common wealth. Sharing money and the economic structures of the state. Unless we have real reforms and political reforms and democratic reforms in the Arab world, I do not see, and I'm not optimistic at all about the situation there. Because what's happening is, hello?
Yes, we're still with you.
Yeah, what's happening is that right now we have over 70% of unemployment in the Muslim and Arab world, from Morocco to Pakistan, and all these people right now are so much oppressed. It's like it's in physics. I mean, if you keep pushing and pushing and pushing something like a balloon, you will push, you will make power into it, and eventually it will explode. I see the
okay.
Arab world.
Thank you very much, Michael. We take your point. Appreciate your comments. Ed, do you want to respond?
Well, there's, I think the politics there are a little beyond my expertise. But I think when you have one point you made about economics, this is what I feel more a little confident on. I think it's quite right that when you have people at work and feeling that their families are going to do okay, political reform, international peacemaking become a lot easier. The social temperature goes down. And a lot of problems that are almost totally unmanageable now become difficult but more possible to solve.
And Michael was also saying, I just want to check this figure. He said there was 70% unemployment in the Muslim world. Is that correct, Ed?
That sounds awfully high to me. The
Did
figure in Jordan before the trade agreement was about 20%. And that's quite high, but I think 70% is a little unreasonable.
One indigenous... Oh, I'm sorry. Let's
okay.
do our pause, and we'll come back.
Okay. Thanks, Jack. Hold the thought. And we'll see if we can find the answer to that unemployment question in the meantime. We're discussing how American trade policy in Muslim countries affects economic development there and ultimately what the repercussions are on the war on terror. So what makes America safer? More defense spending? Or more trade with the Arab world? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
From Boston.
This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about how trade relations between the U.S. and Arab countries are critical in fighting the war on terror. If aid isn't the answer to creating stabilization, is free trade? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we've been talking with Ed Gresser, Director of the Project on Trade and Global Markets for the Progressive Policy Institute. And also with us is regular On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. And Jack, you were about to make an important point when we were overtaken by the clock.
I don't know how important it was. It was hasty, I guess. Just a couple of things. Oxfam, a couple of years ago, did a study of what they really call Western hypocrisy toward the third world. And what they basically found is that for the 49 least developed countries, which include all these countries that Ed is talking about, where 300 million people live below the UN-defined poverty line, U.S. tariffs on goods from those countries cost those countries more than they get in aid foreign aid from the U.S. So in other words, we're costing them more than what we're giving them in aid that's supposed to help them. That's one point. That's the larger context. But to pick up on something Michael said about how the rulers in these parts, in the Middle East, don't share the wealth. There's a Saudi prince whom I have told has built a palace for $2 billion. What he's done is he's recreated an 18th century village behind, and along with his palaces and everything. He's got this population kind of mini Disneyland that he's built all for himself. He purchased the world's largest air conditioner to keep all this cool. Well, where did the money come from that? That doesn't come from oil, most of it. It comes from kickbacks from Western contractors. And that is to say, if you want to sell goods to the Saudi government, defense weapons, the money they pay you is X plus, and they give you back the X. I mean, it is a shakedown on the taxpayers of those countries, but they don't see it because it's all done in the deal with the Western contractors. This is just how these people are living off their own people. And a third point, and an indigenous factor holding these countries back, is the situation of women. They're competing with one hand tied behind their backs, as a study by Arab intellectuals last year pointed out. It's the disfranchisement and the economic disfranchisement of women in the Muslim world that, among all factors, is holding them back economically.
Good point. That's something that one of our callers wanted to speak to as well. Alan is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan?
Yes, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. My point that I would like to state is we should make foreign aid and free trade contingent upon the training of women in vocational skills and also the right to vote. I think that 70% unemployment is probably correct if you include all the women that are not allowed to work. Women allowed to work, as they do in China, the U.S., and all these other countries, they'd be able to dig themselves out really quickly. But the fact they're not allowed to vote, they have no rights. They're basically indentured servants, slaves in all but name. They can't do anything. They'll never dig themselves out. They just keep having more and more kids, and they're just slaves to the bedroom and house cleaning. And how are these people going to dig themselves out? And it's our fault? I don't think it's our fault. They've got to look within and take a look in the mirror and decide to step up to the plate and teach these women skills.
Alan, thanks so much for the call. Ed, I wanted to ask you about that because that is not an area that your report really got into.
That's true. It didn't, and perhaps that's a good criticism. A lot of the 35,000 people the minister is talking about are women.
In Jordan? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
The 35,000 new jobs there.
A lot of them are women right. Workers. I think his name is Michael. I've lost my
name. It was Alan we just heard from
Alan,
just a second
yes.
ago. Yes.
Okay. I think his portrayal is pretty sweeping. In the Muslim world, their treatment of women is quite different from one country to another. I think Saudi Arabia is probably the worst case. Turkey, probably the best case. I think holding trade contingent on these issues is kind of tough because then if you hold trade back, then in a lot of ways it's much harder to find jobs for women. We ought to try and do both, encourage education for women and employment for women as we encourage integration for these countries into the global economy.
And you did find a young man that you cite in your story, Karim, I believe, who was an economics graduate who hadn't been able to find a good job and who said, listen, if we're able to trade peacefully, then you don't need violence.
Yes, he did. This was in a book written by a woman in Morocco named Fatima Marnissi, recounting a conversation after September 11th. And this young man, Karim, who was working two or three jobs as a receptionist at an internet cafe and that sort of thing. He said, when I look at the Muslim world and our Arab countries, if people like me had more to do, then there'd be less attraction to the radical organizations. And that was really one of the things that sort of pushed me to return to the subject and write this study.
All right. I want to take a quick phone call from Joey, calling in from Boston. Clock is ticking, Joey, but we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Hi, thanks for having me. My comment is rather short and probably pretty simplistic, but basically I believe that free trade with the Arab world is one of the most important weapons in the war against terrorism, because once you open up that free trade, Arab countries will have a vested interest in the welfare and economic situation of the U.S. and therefore will ask to or for less aggression against the U.S.
All right. Thank you for keeping it brief, and a very good point indeed. Let me throw this one out to either Ed or Jack. Do you see any, well, perhaps guarantee is too strong a word, any assurance that, we will be safer if our trade policies change?
Well, assurance is a strong word. I think the war on terrorism, the general problems of the Muslim world are very large, and we ought to use all the tools we have at hand. I don't think we're using all the tools we have at hand. You know, you can't be assured that even if you do your best, it'll work, but you should try your best.
And Jack?
I think that the Bush administration is committing what's called the colonel's fallacy. You know, you're in the trenches, you say, I need more men. That's how the colonel looks at it. Well, the general is up above that. He sees it differently. And the president is supposed to see it even differently. They're defining terrorism as a military operation strictly. Not a police one necessarily, and certainly not one that involves economic strategy. So I'm afraid from this administration, given what they did to Pakistan, where everything is on the line, which has nuclear capabilities, and we broke our promises to them. If you can't come through for Pakistan, I don't see what hope there is for these other countries.
And interesting.
I think Jack said it a lot more forcefully than I did.
Well, you both said it very well, and we thank you both for being with us. We've been talking to Ed Gresser, director of the Project on Trade and Global Markets for the Progressive Policy Institute. Also with us has been On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. We thank you both very much, and to everyone who called in and who listened. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. This is On Point. Middle-class angst, escape, and adultery. These are familiar themes in fiction, but what happens when that middle class is situated in Nepal and the adultery takes place amid the modern hustle of Kathmandu? Author Samrat Upadhyay tells a timeless story in an unusual setting in his new book, The Guru of Love. The story of Ramchandra and his mistress, Malathi, is the story of modern Nepal. Not the mystical nation of mountains, backpackers, enlightenment, and hashish, but a nation in transition and people trying to live with political upheaval. Here, author Samrat Upadhyay talks about the challenges he faced writing about Kathmandu, a city that is both ancient and modern at the same time.
Memory is an interesting thing. The Kathmandu that I remember growing up in was a very beautiful city. Nepal didn't open up to the outside world until 1950s. And it's gone through, like, you know, incredible modernization within that time period. Let me give you an example. When I was growing up in Nepal, there was no television. Okay. I left Nepal in 1984. In 1985, the first television show came to Kathmandu. You know, if you imagine a country that was not exposed to the outside world, and then bam, within the span of a decade, you know, I imagine you can even watch Jerry, you know, Springer now. I think the fact that Kathmandu is an ancient city features into my novel, but not in a very deliberate, conscious way. And I'm not sitting down and thinking that I'm going to juxtapose these two worlds. I'm just trying to present Kathmandu, you know, as it is. I'm also a little bit disenchanted with, like, the Western image of Kathmandu, which basically is, you know, well, you have the mountains, you know, and you have the temples and so on. I want to show that those exist only in relationship to the people who are, you know, living in these cities, like living in the city of Kathmandu. So the temple doesn't exist in isolation. The temple is visited by, for example, my mother-in-law every day during her morning walk. So that's the kind of Kathmandu that I'm interested in. I'm always interested in putting my characters in some kind of trouble, because, you know, you twist them around a little bit, it heightens the tension. So, well, adultery is interesting always. And adultery happens more often than I think, you know, a lot of us Nepalis like to admit or talk about. And I think, you know, I mean, I like simple storylines so that I can work at a language that's deeper than the storyline. So I think the surface, the plot is on the surface, you know, but I think the language is doing something else. Now I'm going to read the part of my book where Ramchandra and Malati meet near the Pashupatinath temple, which is a major temple in Kathmandu. And this is the first time that Ramchandra is really going to make a major move on Malati. He felt a tug at his trousers and thought it was her hand, but then he turned and saw a large monkey. It was an arm's length away, watching them. Ramchandra waved a hand to shoo away the monkey, but it blinked once and kept gazing, its eyes watery, as if the creature were saddened by the sight of the two. Malati let out a cry. Ramchandra heaved himself up from the floor and was looking for something to throw at the monkey when two more monkeys entered the temple. All three sat on their haunches and observed Ramchandra and Malati. "Do something," Malati cried, and Ramchandra, scanning the floor, saw the broken elephant trunk lying beside the statue. He picked it up and hurled it at the animals, who merely ducked their heads. A few more monkeys now stood at the entrance of the temple. "Hurry," Ramchandra told Malati. "Let's go." But Malati was frozen on the floor. One of the monkeys approached her and, grabbing the end of her sari, tucked at it, and it began to unwind. Another monkey joined the effort, and soon there was a tug of war between the monkeys and Malati. Malati was screaming, pulling the edges of her sari, while the monkeys, chattering, tugged with great vigor. Ramchandra threatened and shouted, but the monkeys at the entrance had sidled toward him, some of them baring their teeth. Then, incredibly, in one swift motion, Malati's sari was in a large monkey's hand, part of it covering its body so that it looked as if it was the one wearing the blue sari. It ran out the entrance, the sari trailing behind. Malati, in her petticoat and her blouse, feebly tried to cover her chest with her hands, while she whimpered and tears streamed down her face. And then, as if it had all been a big show, the monkeys left the temple one by one. Ramchandra went to Malati and put his hand on her shoulder. She jerked it away and buried her face in her knees. Scratch marks covered her legs and her hair was disheveled. Ramchandra stood there, helpless, afraid to touch her again. But he had an idea. "Stay right here," he said. "I'll be back soon." "I don't want to be here alone," she said in a muffled voice. "I'll only be a few minutes." He walked out and headed toward the main temple of Pashupatinath, wondering whether the gods had sent the monkeys as punishment for what he was doing. After he crossed the small bridge, he found a shop that displayed saris and, cursing himself over and over, bought a cotton dhoti for 70 rupees. When he returned, Malati was in the same position. She took the sari silently, and as she put it on, he turned away. They walked out of the temple, down the steps towards Guesuri, and when she told him she wanted to walk home alone, he didn't object. It was only 11 o'clock, and Ramchandra wondered whether he should go to the school to teach some classes. But the prospect of standing in front of the classroom and solving mathematical problems on the board depressed him. His mind whirled with images of Malati crouching on the floor in her petticoat and bra, monkey scratches on her thighs, and her face contorted in terror as the monkeys unrobed her.
Samrat Upadhyay reading from his book, The Guru of Love. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our